Today on Poetry on the Radio, Tony Turner, the former longtime head of drama at the Australian National University, talks about Shakespeare's verse techniques in his plays and particularly in his sonnets, plus the rhyming bugle, poetry news from around the ACT. I'm Peter Searles. Much honoured director and actor Tony Turner was formerly the Ethel Torrey Head of Drama at the ANU. Among awards he has received are the Italian Ministry of Culture Bronze Medal for Theatre, the Canberra Critics Circle Award for Best Actor, and 3 Canberra Area Theatre Awards for Best Production. He was the Artistic Director of the Paper Moon Theatre Group at the ANU, with numerous directing credits, including Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra. After training at the Central School of Speech and Drama in London, Tony Turner went on to a variety of positions in theatre and the arts, including Chief Adjudicator for the Chinese University's Shakespeare Festival in Hong Kong. In Canberra, he has directed many productions for Canberra Rep and the Paper Moon Company. His acting credits have included Shakespeare's King Lear and Brutus in Julius Caesar. At the Canberra Area Theatre Awards, he was awarded Best Actor in a Leading Role in 2015 for his portrayal of the older Casanova in Canberra Rep's Casanova. In the Canberra Area Theatre Awards for 2017, his production of Goldsmith's She Stoops to Conquer was nominated in 10 categories, including Best Director, again for Canberra Rep. He continues often to direct and appear in Canberra Area productions, including in many episodes of Art Sound Radio Theatre. We hear him today in conversation with Bart Meehan, host and producer of Art Sound Radio Theatre, which airs right before this program at 4 p.m. on Sundays, repeated at 10 p.m. on Mondays.
Tony, for those of us who know Shakespeare but don't really know Shakespeare, can you explain the structure of his language?
Pretty much everything that he wrote, it was almost everything he wrote, not everything, is in the structure which we call iambic pentameter. Now, let me explain that. Iambic means that the rhythm goes unstressed, stressed. So, ba-boom, 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 okay? That's the rhythm of iambic, and it's important. Pentameter means there are 5 of those feet, in other words, 10 beats in all, 5 unstressed and 5 stressed. And he uses that structure for a very good reason. What we have to remember is that there were no directors in Shakespeare's day. There was no one there to tell the actor how to do it or what to do. So the playwright, and all the playwrights did this, the playwrights wrote their plays so that the actor could know how to say a line because of the iambic pentameter structure. And because there was no director and because the playwright had to do it, the actor was able to actually do some of the things that we do today in the way that people act in that. I guess it's to do with intention and objective, which kind of emerged at the beginning of the 20th century with Stanislavski and the Moscow Art Theatre. I had a long conversation some years ago with Cicely Berry, who is, or was before she died, poor love, the director of the Royal Shakespeare Company, the director of voice, the voice department at the Royal Shakespeare Company. And she said to me, the intention is in the line. It's in the rhythm of the line, and you don't need to look anywhere else. And the example she gave was this. It's probably the most famous line in Shakespeare. To be or not to be, that is the question. Now, what we do today, or actors seem to do today, is say, to be or not to be, that is the question. There's a kind of rhythm in that. But if you look at the iambic rhythm, it changes. It changes the meaning and it changes the intention. Because the iambic rhythm means that what you have to say is to be or not to be. That is the question. In other words, there's no other question in the world, as opposed to just being, well, shall I commit suicide or not? And all the way through all the texts, that kind of thing is very important, is that you find what the line really means. Do you see how the intention is in that line if you hit the rhythm properly? Anyway, that rhythm, that structure, is in all the sonnets. And some people say it was invented at the time. In fact, there's an argument that Christopher Marlowe invented iambic pentameter, but it's not true. In fact, iambic pentameter was being used many, many years before Shakespeare wrote the sonnet.
There's an argument that Christopher Marlowe wrote Shakespeare, isn't there?
There is an argument. We still don't know who wrote the plays. We know probably that Shakespeare wrote some of them, but we really don't know. I'm not going to go into that at this time. So what I'd like to do is the first poem I'd like to read was written much earlier than Shakespeare, in the same century, but much earlier, about 1509, 1510. It was written by Sir Thomas Wyatt, who was a courtier at the court of Henry VIII. And there is conjecture that he had an affair with Anne Boleyn. And this poem is about, we think, Anne Boleyn. And it's in iambic pentameter. So I'll just read this one to give you what iambic pentameter is and what a love poem was early in the same century as Shakespeare. They flee from me that sometime did me seek, with naked foot stalking in my chamber. I have seen them, gentle, tame, and meek, that now are wild, and do not remember that sometime they put themselves in danger to take bread at my hand, and now they range busily seeking with a continual change. Thank be for fortune, it hath been otherwise, 20 times better, but once in special, in thin array after a pleasant guise, when her loose gown from her shoulders did fall, and she me caught in her arms long and small, therewithal sweetly did me kiss, and softly said, dear heart, how like you this? It was no dream. I lay broad waking, but all is turned through my gentleness into a strange fashion of forsaking, and I have leave to go of her goodness, and she also to use new fangleness. But since that I am so kindly served, I would fain know what she hath deserved. So, yeah, I mean, it could easily also be what Anne Boleyn is facing.
Today on Poetry on the Radio, renowned Canberra-based actor and director Tony Turner is reflecting on the poetic approaches of Shakespeare in his plays and particularly his sonnets.
All right, let's get to the sonnets. I'm going to start with probably the most famous of all the sonnets. The first line, of course, is one everyone knows. And it's actually sonnet number 18. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date. Sometime too hot the eye of heaven shines, and often is his gold complexion dimmed, and every fair from fair sometime declines, by chance or nature's changing course untrimmed. But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou owest, Nor shall death brag thou wanderest in his shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growest. So long as men can breathe, or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee. And we must remember that there's 154 of them, and we must remember that about 125 of them were written to a man, and that was written to a man. We think it was the Earl of Southampton, but we will never know, who was much younger than Shakespeare. And Shakespeare makes quite a lot of that, the fact that he's older and the boy is younger. He was an earl and therefore much higher status than Shakespeare. And most of the poems are about his beauty, but they're also about Shakespeare saying, come on, you've got to get on and we've got to have progeny. It's the only way you're going to survive.
And this was mysterious dedicatee, the Mr. W?
Yes, that's the one. Mm. We don't know who he is. Mm-hmm. We'll never know. But there is evidence that these sonnets were written by Shakespeare.
What sort of evidence?
The evidence is of a man called Francis Deer, I believe his name was, who published some poetry in 1609, some of which was Shakespeare's poems, there's a record of him saying that he knows about Shakespeare and knows that he wrote the sonnets. So mm-hmm. that's the only definite information about Shakespeare writing anything.
But close to contemporaneous.
Close to him, yeah. So the other person that he wrote the sonnets to was the famous Dark Lady. I'll read some more of those about the young man, but I think it's important to know that the rest of the poetry, rest of the sonnets, were written to the Dark Lady. It kind of tells us that she was dark-skinned. She had crinkly hair. So it's interesting to know who she was, because he will kind of never know, but I guess she could have been Mediterranean, but because he actually talks about so much darkness, and he uses the word black, mm-hmm. she could easily have been from Africa. And it's very interesting in 1589 that there was such a person living in England.
You would think that would be somebody so unusual that it would be reasonably easy to identify.
Exactly, there have been attempts to do that, unsatisfactorily, but there have been attempts to do that. Mm. And it's another famous one. It's "My Mistress' Eyes Are Nothing Like the Sun." I'll read it. "My mistress' eyes are nothing like the sun. Coral is far more red than her lips red. If snow be white, why then her breasts are dun. If hairs be wires, black wires grow on her head. I've seen roses damasked, red and white, but no such roses see I in her cheeks. And in some perfumes is there more delight than in the breath that from my mistress reeks. I love to hear her speak, yet well I know that music hath a far more pleasing sound. I grant I never saw a goddess go. My mistress, when she walks, treads on the ground. And yet, by heaven, I think my love as rare as any she belied with false compare." She doesn't have bad breath. Reeks in that at that time just meant breathes forth. but everyone thinks it means she's got bad breath, but it's not true. So you can see it does describe someone who isn't English.
Mm-mm. And again, it's interesting because the uniqueness of somebody from even a Mediterranean background associating with Shakespeare, you would think would appear in record somewhere.
Yeah, you would think so. This one is the one about lust. It's actually a poem about sex. It's about the act of sex. It's about the orgasm. It's extraordinary. This is number 129 and probably written about the Dark Lady. The expense of spirit in a waste of shame, and spirit in this context actually does mean semen. Mm. It means the act of sex. The expense of spirit in a waste of shame is lust in action. And till action, lust is perjured, murderous, bloody, full of blame, savage, extreme, rude, cruel, not to trust, enjoyed no sooner, but despised straight, past reason hunted, and no sooner had, past reason hated, as a swallowed bait on purpose laid to make the taker mad. Mad in pursuit and in possession, so had, having, and in quest to have, extreme, a bliss in proof and proved a very woe. Before, a joy proposed, behind, a dream. All this the world well knows, yet none knows well to shun the heaven that leads men to this hell. It's an amazing poem for the time. Okay, I'll just do one more, and then I'd like to show you what happens after that. One poem I'll do after that. This is number 73, and it's all about getting old. That time of year thou mayst in me behold, when yellow leaves, or none or few, do hang upon those boughs which shake against the cold, bare ruined choirs, where late the sweet birds sang. In me thou seest the twilight of such day, as after sunset fadeth in the west, which by and by black night doth take away, death's second self that seals up all in rest. In me thou seest the glowing of such fire that on the ashes of his youth doth lie, as the deathbed whereon it must expire, consumed with that which it was nourished by. This thou perceivest, which makes thy love more strong, to love that well which thou must leave ere long. So again, it's to a young man. And it's a very strong poem, because he's saying, look, I'm an old man and you're a young man and you still love me. Extraordinary poem. Okay, and then this is a poem written in the following century by a playwright called Andrew Marvell, and it's called To His Coy Mistress, and again is another poem, and a poem that encourages, and again it's when they broke away from iambic pentameter. It's still iambic, but it's not, the lines are not as long, and it makes a difference to the rhythm.
Well, why did they break away from it? It was just simply an evolution of theatre?
It was the Cavalier Poets. I mean, at the time, we're talking about after The King Comes Back, and the Cavaliers, they came back from Europe, and the first thing that the King did was open a theatre, right? And it was a time of trying to break away from the Puritans again, because the Puritans had shut everything down and everybody had to be Christian and so on. When the King came back, it was kind of all on for young and old. And just as in 1956, Look Back in Anger changed theatre forever, this period in the late 17th century was when things were changed forever. So this is to his coy mistress. Had we but world enough and time, this coyness, lady, were no crime. We would sit down and think which way to walk and pass our long love's day. Thou by the Indian Ganges side should rubies find. I by the tide of Humber would complain. I would love you 10 years before the flood, and you should, if you please, refuse till the conversion of the Jews. My vegetable love should grow vaster than empires and more slow. 100 years should go to praise thine eyes and on thy forehead gaze. 200 to adore each breast, but 30,000 to the rest. An age at least to every part, and the last age should show your heart. For, lady, you deserve this state, nor would I love at lower rate. But at my back I always hear time's winged chariot hurrying near, and yonder all before us lie deserts of vast eternity. Thy beauty shall no more be found, nor in thy marble vault shall sound my echoing song. Then worms shall try that long-preserved virginity, and your quaint honour turn to dust, and into ashes all my lust. The graves are fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace. Now, therefore, while the youthful hue sits on thy skin like morning dew, and while thy willing soul transpires at every pore with instant fires, now let us sport us while we may, and now, like amorous birds of prey, rather at once our time devour than languish in his slow-chapped power. Let us roll all our strength and all our sweetness up into one ball and tear our pleasures with rough strife through the iron gates of life. Thus, though we cannot make our sun stand still, yet we will make him run.
It's marvellous. So in the context of those poems, you're seeing a change in the rhythm, in the actual structure of the poem.
Mm.
In that, say, 100 years, had Shakespeare fallen out of fashion?
Well, I guess you could describe it like that, that the theatres were closed when the king had his head chopped off.
Mm.
And the court, who was all the ones that were left England and ended up in Europe, mostly in Holland, but also in France. They didn't come back until 1666. And we're talking from 1642 to 1666. There was no joy. There was no dancing. There was no singing. There was no theatre. There was nothing because of the Puritans. Mm. So Shakespeare was not revived until middle of the 18th century, beginning of the 18th century. And because the fashion for theatre had changed, he was rewritten. And so everyone had to have a happy ending, for instance. there was a man called Colley Cibber who rewrote the plays, and so at the end of Lear, Lear doesn't die. Cordelia doesn't die. She marries Edgar. Romeo and Juliet don't die. They get married and reunite the two houses, and everyone lives happily ever after. And
would have done very well in Hollywood, wouldn't they?
They would have done very well in Hollywood, and that's where Hollywood gets it from, I guess. Because the good have to be rewarded and the bad punished. And so Shakespeare, in its full form, his original form, was not performed until 1912, when Twelfth Night was performed in London.
So it's very interesting. And going back to one of your first comments, you said that there were no directors in Shakespeare's time, so the actors had to take direction from the language.
From the script, yeah.
Yeah. When directors were introduced into the process, do you think directors understood that? Did they change it? Or did they understand that and allow the language to take a prominent place in the performance?
No. In fact, what tended to happen, because the language in the 19th century, for instance, even though the plays were rewritten in endings that were happy, the text was still used, all right? And it's when the great actor managers began performing the great melodramas and performing in such a way, first of all, because the theatres were so big, they had to be big themselves, both physically and vocally. And in fact, voice became the most important thing for an actor because he had to fill a space. And in fact, when the drama schools began, and that wasn't until the late 19th, early 20th century, the list of things that actors were trained in began with voice. And the second thing was movement. And the third thing was acting. Acting wasn't regarded as the most important thing to train actors to do, which is extraordinary. Mm. Because that's exactly what drama schools now do, is acting is the most important thing. And voice and movement is still there, but it's acting that people teach. So the directors were really the actor managers of the 19th century, which really simply told the actors when to come on, where to stand. They would... there was always lots of stage fight. And actors were taught to do things that everybody else knew how to do. So you could have two actors who turn up, never met each other, and they could do a stage fight because they knew the fight. Okay, so in that sense, the stage, the actor manager was a kind of director, but it wasn't about what directors do today, which is, you know, look at the whole play and what's this about and ask actors. I still think, my personal opinion is that directors only need to tell actors two things. One is do nothing. And the amount of times you have to say stop acting. And the other is, can you do it better? And everything a director says is based on those two things.
I forget which actor said it, but they said, the moment you realise you're acting, you're not.
Yep.
And I think that's probably very true. Well, thank you, Tony. That's a very interesting insight into Shakespeare, into the sonnets. And when people hear the plays, they'll hopefully see something new or hear and see something new in those performances.
Yeah.
Today on Poetry on the Radio, renowned Canberra-based actor and director Tony Turner has shared some thoughts on the poetic approaches of Shakespeare in his plays and particularly his sonnets. I'm Peter Searles.
The Rhyming Bugle. Coming soon to Smith's Alternative in Civic on December 16, that poetry thing is an end-of-year open mic. ArtSound FM is a listener-supported community radio station. You can support the station's many arts-related broadcasts by donating or becoming a member through our website, artsound.fm. Poetry on the Radio is heard Sundays at 4:30 p.m. and Mondays at 10:30 p.m. on ArtSound FM. The program is produced weekly on unceded First Nations country in the studios of ArtSound FM in Canberra. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles. Producer is Peter Monahan. Our theme is from an ancient hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregorio Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.